everybody. Welcome to another edition of Points on the Board. This is your host, Big John.
And William Del Pilar, the conservative Latino.
Rarantino. Oh, boy, I love that whole Latino, Hispanic.
Chicano.
Boy, that's something I haven't heard since the mid-70s, William.
Yeah, that's about the time I remember going to college, Chicano studies. Because, you know, out here in California,
right.
it's a predominant ethnicity. Is it ethnicity or culture? I can always forget.
I don't know. It's interchangeable to me. But you know what made me think of that was that sitcom in the 70s with Freddie Prinze and Eddie Albertson. It was called
Go on the Man.
Yeah.
Until the Day.
Yeah. Freddie Prinze.
We were a crush. Yeah. I mean, not like Bill Cosby or OJ crush, but it was crushing because it's one of the shows that my dad liked. So my dad being a workaholic, the only time I ever saw him was when we watched the Boob Tube.
And what's funny is I'm sure being based on a Hispanic lead.
Puerto Rican, I think.
He was supposed to be Puerto Rican in the show. And I'm sure that meant something, right? Because you didn't see too many of those characters in the mid-70s necessarily.
Right. And it was New York City. New York City has a big, I call them New York Ricans. You know, I have a checkered belief with my Puerto Rican side of the culture because we're so dependent on the American dollars and as a welfare state, as a welfare island. It's kind of disgusting, sad. And it's all the above. It's something that there is no right or wrong answer anymore.
Right.
It's never going to change because it's a beast now. That system is a beast. 60% of their island's funding comes through welfare, through the three. I think we send like $3 or $6 billion to that island.
Yeah. Well, it's a great tax haven if you're wealthy. Like I know Peter Schiff decided to leave the U.S. mainland and go to Puerto Rico, and he's living the life. He's just like, I get nobody.
The people are great. The island's great. I love my relatives there. Yeah. You know what's funny is my relatives, being gay is not very, it's frowned upon. The U.S. is probably the most progressive country when it comes to being gay outside of Europe. Latin American countries, Asian countries, African countries, no. It's still old school.
Well, Brazil has a big gay community, right? They're pretty.
So does Panama. So does Puerto Rico.
Brazil seems to be more accepting of it, though, aren't they?
I've been to Brazil, but I'm not Brazilian. Brazilian's unique because it's actually Portuguese. It's not Spaniard. It was a Portuguese conquered Brazil. So their culture, but at the end of the day, it's the same population in terms of ratio or percentage, in all these countries. But it's they're not as out in the closet. But my Puerto Rican side, boy, the flamboyant ones, boy, they're all proud. And we don't care. You know? It's like they don't tell us, but you can obviously see it as they wear it on their sleeves. And it's just kind of funny because the Panamanian side, it's very still taboo. I don't think I've ever met somebody who is openly gay from Panama. Of course, they're there. I'm sure they are.
Right.
But I've never really met one. Well, it's not that I run in those circles, but in Puerto Rico, hell, my family alone, they don't care. So it's kind of refreshing because there's something to be said about being your own person. I think you know that about me.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's get the show going, Big John. What do we got?
As interesting as that was, and I want to hear more about flamboyant Puerto Ricans, possibly in orange jumpsuits with sequins. I'm not sure. But
Big John wants to meet flamboyant Puerto Ricans. Okay.
Hey, man, I went to school in Washington Heights. I grew up around them. So anyway, let's talk about what's going to be on the show today, William. We've got a great show. We're going to talk about the NCAA men's basketball champions. A new winner was crowned this year, the other night. Another big trade in the NFL, but a little bit of a strange one. We'll talk about that. And also Frank Gore. Old man Frank finally deciding to hang it up for, of all things, I believe, to go into celebrity boxing. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about his place in NFL history and then also some other topics. But let's start off with, as they say, at the beginning, first things first, let's talk about the NCAA men's hoops. This one was a nail-biter, and it was a pretty good tourney. A lot of Cinderella runs, of course. Was it St. Peter's? Duke, the whole story with Coach K's final season. So that was a nice storyline in there. You had the upstart UNC, and in the semifinals, UNC and Duke. You know, that rivalry, of course.
Exciting tournament.
Yeah, it was a really great tournament. But at the end, Kansas comes out on top, 72-69. Great game. Very exciting. William, talk to us about it. What were your thoughts on the game and the tourney?
Well, the tourney itself was phenomenal. The upsets this season, every year the upsets are the same. We say the same thing. But that's part of the game. This is why I'm going to digress for 30 seconds.
Go ahead.
This is why college football needs to have a tournament of 32 teams. And they can do it. They choose not to. And it could benefit literally every college in this country, but the greed of the SEC, the big Pac-10, the ACC, the ones who are locked into those big it's a disgrace. It's a conspiracy because they're working together. Because there's nothing that says they can't. You know,
right.
It's between the TV contracts, it's and who suffers? The players. Because as much as it pains me to say, I believe amateur athletics shouldn't be paid, but I change. I'm like, when a university and the system it's in earns billions and the coaching staff or the head coach, mostly basketball here, gets 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 to 10 million dollar contracts by Nike or Adidas and they tell their kids, they don't ask them, you're going to wear these shoes. You know, that it's a corrupt system.
And well, so, you know what's interesting? I read that when you look at the highest paying government positions.
Oh, they're college coaches.
It's college coaches of state schools.
Yeah.
In some of them, it might be like a university president or something, like the state university president might be the highest paid. But in many states, surprisingly, it's either the head football coach or the head men's basketball coach.
Right. Well, that's not surprising to me. I've been following this for decades.
Yeah,
it's a corrupt system. You know, I'm a conservative. You're libertarian.
Yeah.
This is where the leftism in me comes out. You know, I'm like, no. These are old, white, good old boys. And when I say good old boys, I'm not talking about the South. I'm just talking, people forget, you know, people forget slavery ended in the South before it did in the North, technically speaking, you know, so it's not like you're going to say it's this good old boy systems, because in the North, you got Seton Hall, you got Connecticut.
It's cronyism is what you meant to say.
Cronyism.
And before we get too much off topic, I just wanted to say, I agree with you, and it's not a liberal in you. It's actually a conservative libertarian side of you because, look, I think push comes to shove. There shouldn't be any state schools. So if you want to have a university that puts the emphasis on athletics and that's who they value and that's what they pay, great. Create a school around athletics. That's fine. I have no problem with that.
Well,
I have a problem when it's tax funded, right? So that's my problem. And I agree with you. I used to have like a very idealistic view of amateur sports, the Olympics. And I'm like, pay all of them now. Who cares? Because it was going under the table anyway. And now we're going to pretend like Soviet bloc countries didn't pay and train their athletes to compete in the Olympics while we were starving our college kids to why? All they did was they gave them officer ranks in their armies, and they ate and they lived like kings. You know, they didn't have to live for a living.
That's absolutely correct.
And they got around it that way. Yeah, they got around it that way.
Funded their especially the ice hockey team.
So
it's kind of funny.
I've swung around to your way of thinking on that too, but.
No, I'm just thinking Lake Placid. Was it 1980 or 1984?
1980.
Lake Placid. You know, all these officers and enlisted men in the Russian army, you know.
Colonel Tretiak involved.
Yeah, but they had great duty stations in Cuba, who knows else. After that game, they were all headed to their newest station.
That was horrible for them.
What did they send everybody to? The gulags?
Yeah, the gulags out in Siberia. But
back to the game.
Yeah, let's talk about Kansas. What did you think about Kansas-UNC?
Well, as you said, it was 72-69. It was a great tournament. it was tough for me. I'm a big Coach K fan because, as I told you before, he teaches his boys to become men. They learn. They get educated. They're not like Kentucky, one and done. Well, actually, Duke has become one and done, so Duke has fallen into that too. But that said, we're going to talk a little bit about that towards the end, as well as the fact that of all these regs and NCAA issues. But this game ended a 14-year drought. The last time Kansas won a championship was in 2008, and Bill Self was the coach. Ironically, I don't know if it was his first or second season after Roy, I'm drawing a blank, but Roy Williams left to go become the coach at UNC. And so those were really Roy Williams players. But Bill Self won the national championship. Ironically, Roy Williams won the national championship with his predecessor's players, you know? And I don't think he won it with his own players. I thought it was a bad hire of Roy Williams. That was purely cronyism and old school politics in running somebody who didn't deserve to get run out to bring a good old boy in. I was never a Roy Williams fan to the day he dies. Get out of here. Yeah, but Bill Self ran the program. 2008 won the championship. I want to say he was in another title game and he lost Kentucky. So this was his third appearance. And he overcame the largest deficit in NCAA history. At one point, they were down by 16 points. At halftime, they were down by 15 points. This is what I found impressive. This is what I look for in a coach. Growing up, I never had the killer instinct. I learned and was taught the killer instinct when I was a young adult. Right. And I took it to heart. If your opponent is down, you put a foot on their neck.
You put the boots on their neck.
You put them down like a rabid dog.
Right.
And as they entered the half, North Carolina had played their game. That's why they were dominating. They were playing their style game. And they needed defense. So Bill Self gave him the speech, you know, pretty much said, hey, look, my last championship team, we were down by 9 and like with 2 minutes left. What's harder to come back? 15 with 20 minutes or 9 and 2 minutes? Oh, 9 and 2 minutes. So his whole point was, yeah, see, this is doable. But what was impressive was the defense they played, Big John. Within 2 minutes and 30 seconds in a 20-minute half, they caught up. I mean, unless you follow basketball, you really don't understand how impressive that is.
Yeah, in 2.5 minutes to make up 15 points is incredible.
Exactly. And when I was talking about putting that foot on that neck and just twisting your foot and crushing it, that's kind of what that defense did to the UN Center. And I love pronouncing his name. I don't know how it's pronounced, but it's Armando Bacol is what I say. Probably Bacol, Bacol.
Just as good a pronunciation as any, William.
Yeah. No. I mean, if I'm him and I'm in a club, what's your name? Armando Bacol.
You do it with a nice collared suit, wide lapels, sort of like a black and white outfit with a little hat, maybe a
Cabana shirt. I was in a jazz club in Jacksonville, Florida once. I'm the liest person there. Once they found out I was Puerto Rican, they couldn't stay off me.
So, of course.
Who knows what affects people, but Armando Bacol. Anyway, Armando's the center. He was solid the first half, suffered an ankle injury in the Duke game, and they didn't really take it to him. Yet, what they did was they forced Bacol away from the rim. And by forcing him away from the rim, his gimpy ankle came more into play.
Right.
Because when you're that close to the rim, you really move here, move there, boom, block. He had to actually
come out
and cover, and they ate him alive. And he re-injured his ankle with about 38 seconds left, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And as you know as well as I do, 38 seconds is not much time, but in basketball, that
can last an hour. Yeah, it can last an hour.
Exactly. And, you know, so what they did is they took advantage of his injury and put the foot down on the neck and just twisted. And they came away with a victory, and it was a well-earned victory. And the reason I say that is, this is competitive sports. You know, I used to believe in that crap honor. No.
Sportsmanship.
No, there's sportsmanship I do believe in. But what they did was just tough strategy to win the game. They took advantage. Oh, he took advantage of the fact that he was hurt. So, it's not my fault.
Why is he in there? That's why you have a bench.
Yeah, there was an article when I was doing my research, and the way he didn't come out, he or she didn't come out and say it, but you could kind of sense they didn't like the fact that they took advantage of a guy with a gippy ankle. And I'm like, well, that's why you're a reporter, barely earning above minimum wage, and you're not going to be earning multi-millions out there as a coach or a player. Yeah, it just irks me when people put their morality just write about the article. Right. But that said, what we were talking about, the corruption. Well, it was kind of ironic because Kansas won, and Kansas is currently dealing with potential violations that the NCAA has against them. 5 level 1 violations that were labeled egregious and severe. Now, the school is claiming innocence. I didn't know that was happening.
Right.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what's your take on college? Well, let me get a little bit into it, then I want to hear your libertarian take. So, in essence, what happened is Adidas refs, and I would suspect Adidas is the wink wink, we don't know what's happening, but right. Yeah, go ahead and pay the players to come to the school. So what happens is the Nike, Adidas, New Balance, whatever shoes are doing this, they kind of take these programs under their wing and support them with money, you know, legally, you know, stuff that they can do legally, big contract for the coach, for the kids who wear the shoes. And when you have an NCAA powerhouse sporting your shoes, you know, obviously marketing is going to generate some sales. So two of their players were paying families to come to Kansas. No different than what Nike does. No different than what Reebok does. This is how the game is played. So Kansas is playing innocent. They're playing innocent to the point. They got some smart lawyers. He said, yo, boss. Let's go ahead and try to sue them, get our money back so we look good. So they're trying to collect $1.1 million in restitution for one of the individuals. But here's the irony that I see, Big John. These 2 out of the 3 men went to prison. The third man didn't go to prison because he was testifying against the 2 men. Right. You know? So the 2 men went to prison for paying kids from the ghetto, kids from the trailer park, kids from the barrio. That's right. That's all politically incorrect, so screw these people. But the reason I say that is those are the kids that don't have money. So this is – the bribes were anywhere from 1,000 to upwards. It doesn't take much to bribe somebody who's poor. You know, my parents have been there. They worked hard, so I wouldn't have to affect that. But my take to you, John, is with all these professional athletes getting paid, these coaches getting paid, I mean, don't you see the issues with, you're going to throw him in jail because he was trying to pay the kid?
Yeah, it is a ludicrous position that the NCAA holds. Listen, here's my belief. Call it libertarian, call it Big John's beliefs, whatever. Just get rid of all that regulation. Get rid of it. All it does, like you said, is it encourages and facilitates avoidance.
Right.
It facilitates under the table nonsense. Every so often, the NCAA will spin a wheel and say, okay, who are we going to catch for violations? Kansas or Clemson or whatever, right? Because they every so often they'll like to flex their muscles. But the truth of the matter is, like you said, it's obvious who gets the perks. It's the kids who can't get in on an academic scholarship, right?
Well, actually, most of them get in on an academic scholarship, and that's the whole point. These scholarships are so damn, or just the rules in general, are so restrictive, they can't even hold a job.
Well, that's the other thing. So my whole point would be just like carte blanche. This is like when these socialists and communists talk about exploitation, it's usually nonsense, almost always nonsense. This is exploitation of the student athletes because they never agreed to work for slave wages while you.
Actually, they did, John.
Well, let me take it back.
You have this funny feeling that contracts aren't signed.
No. I let me take it back. My wording was wrong. What I meant to say is, it is exploitation in the sense that it's not a free market. They're not free to go from school to school. They're not free. Like, look, if you and I are working for an employer, we can quit and go somewhere else.
John, they do have a transfer portal, but it's not like they can quit. They have to go through a process,
right? And it takes.
And then there are rules about eligibility, right. But it's there. I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
it's a corrupt system.
Just let it go, is my opinion. Just let it go. Have everybody.
Sadly, you can't. because corruption. You see, John, I firmly believe, and you probably disagree, but I firmly believe, sure, there's a lot of politicians who want to make new laws and have their names attached for political reasons, but I believe early on, at least, a lot of new laws were created because there were no laws, and human nature with money men who own businesses, and as they grow and get bigger, it just becomes corrupt. So if there's no law there, they're going to – easiest example, why were child labor laws created?
I don't know. There shouldn't be any child labor laws.
They were created because they were exploiting kids in factories. See, that's my whole point, John.
No. There shouldn't be child labor laws.
Huh? Libertarianism is based off I think this utopia that we're going to be honest, but child labor laws were created because they were exploiting those kids in the factories when the industrial, probably well before, but when the industrial revolution began, it exploded. So my whole point is, I agree with you. See, people think that conservatives, more libertarians, don't want laws. It's not that we don't want laws. We want the minimum laws. You know, it's kind of like, remember the pollution of the 70s?
We want laws for where crimes are committed. That's it. Like,
right.
So in any time you tell me we need a law for X, in this case, NCAA, corruption, whatever, my question is always the following. What crime are you solving? What crime are you preventing? And I'm being very careful by saying crime. Who is the victim?
Right.
Crimes, whatever. So, for example, if...
Well, no, John, that's actually what in college the biggest issue they had are bribing. These boosters who pay, that's pretty much a bribe. I'm bribing you to come to college. Really, what are you doing?
What's the difference between a bribe and a bonus?
No, no, I'm not going to get into that aspect because I'm not a lawyer.
I'm just saying.
That's where, after 10 years of meeting with my lawyer, because the internet was a new medium and there was no legalities, I had come to understand the nuance of legalese writing or whatever they say.
Right.
So I think this is one of those cases we can't even get up the bat because we're not lawyers. That's how complicated these type of
I understand what you're saying, but I'm saying forget the law momentarily. I'm asking you philosophically. What is the difference between the following? I'm an employee, and it's happened to me in my life where, like, two companies are bidding on my services, right?
No. We're not talking companies. We're talking a school system, and there's a massive difference that I'll get into when I answer your question.
Yeah. So, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but what is the difference between two companies bidding for my services and saying, hey, we'll both offer you $250K a year. Oh, wow, I'm trying to decide between the two. And then one says, look, sign with us. Here's another $50K.
Because for lack of a better way of saying it, that's the real world. The university system is about competition, about education. I'm telling you how it supposedly started. It's become a business, you know, but at the end of the day, it's about competitive play. It's in the real world, in business, it's not about competitive play. You guys go at each other and supply and demand, the laws of economics take over. That's not how the university system is built, nor is it how it's supposed to work. You're comparing apples to oranges. I'm not disagreeing with your philosophy, but what you're using to kind of define it is apples to oranges. It's a completely
different system. No, it's not. As a wise man once said, it's all economics, and I'll leave it at that. But let me just
– Milton Friedman was human. He wasn't perfect. I do want to mention about Bill Self and Hubert Davis.
Yeah, I was going to say, wrap it up. Let's talk about what you think.
So this is Bill Self's second title. And ironically, Bill Self is part of this investigation, but yet Kansas went ahead anyway and gave him a lifetime contract.
Why not?
Yeah. Now, Bill Self cemented Bill Self into NCAA legacy, you know, because the way he won this game, it's his second championship, third appearance, I believe, and he's tied for the most championships now amongst active coaches because Mike Krzyzewski retired. He's tied with Rick Pitino, who's now an Iona coach. Man, talk about a fall from grace. But he's 59, you know, Twilight years. And Villanova's Jay Wright, who I've never heard of. You know, my point being is Bill Self and Jay Wright, they're really nobodies, whereas people – no Patino outside NCAA. Right, right. So my point being is Bill Self is still creating his legacy, his greatness. So he's still young enough. He's still got many years. So this was a huge victory for him, especially, I don't know if you follow it closely, but Kansas teams have kind of imploded throughout the years, meaning they're either great or they're supposed to be great, then they get imploded. In other words, they're the team that gets upset in the tournament. In fact, last year they got upset.
Typically speaking, you're right.
Exactly. Hubert Davis now.
Hubie Davis.
He's really a new coach. You know, he's part of the Tar Heel legacy. Player, won a national championship, or at least went to one. Head coach, he's taking his team. I think he may be the only guy who's done that, or maybe one or two.
Yeah, and he played in for the Knicks in the NBA. I know that much. He's a New York favorite, too, you know, just because
of the Knicks. Right. So, Carolina basketball is to the ACC and the NCAA what the Yankees are to baseball. You know, so he had a great run. He had a subpar regular season by North Carolina standards, meaning he lost games he shouldn't have lost. However, his victories over Duke and Krzyzewski's farewell tour.
As it turned out, yeah.
It's part of those. Well, you're kind of like a C plus B minus student there, Hubert. But if you do this extra credit, man, that can bump you up to a B plus A minus.
Right, and that's exactly what happened. Yep.
Yeah, especially in the Final Four to have that win. Now, sadly, that probably gives him enough. What do they call it? Extension, enough rope for that's actually a wrong term to use, Hubert Davis. My apologies.
it gives him leeway.
Leeway, yes, gives them some leeway for about 1 to 2 years, so he'll be safe next year unless the team collapses. But they still want to see tournament results, right. So that's the pressure of being a Carolina coach. But overall, that run has won him accolades. It well deserved, you know. He put UNC back into the spotlight.
Yeah, I agree, and honestly, I think it works out for him in terms of. Just having a nice base to build on. He's only a second year coach, so this will fare him well going forward. The experience, the accolades for again stomping on Duke. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, rivalries in college basketball. So I think that works out very nicely for him. I want to wrap up the segment by shouting out one of our friends, Thomas Casale. We're hoping to get him on soon. Big Tom had Kansas before the season started as his eventual champion.
Wow.
So he collected a futures bet, and he was so confident. If you follow him on Twitter, I'll throw out a free thing for Tom. He refused to take the hedge bet. So because he had the futures bet on Kansas, he had a certain amount of money locked in, right? And much like me with the Super Bowl with the Bengals and the Rams, all he had to do was put a hedge bet on UNC. But he was so confident, he said, that's it. I'm rolling with Kansas. I'm doubling down on Kansas. So he ended up winning. Now, the irony was, had he taken the hedge bet, he would have won both bets because the spread was
– How much did he win?
I don't know. But the futures bet was plus 1,800. So it was 18 to 1. So whatever he put down, he got an 18 to 1 spread on the way back.
You know, my friend made my Ravens bet. I predicted that they would go to the Super Bowl. I didn't predict them to win, that they would go to the Super Bowl. And that was the year they went to the Super Bowl. But my friend who lives in Vegas placed the bet for me. And he actually told me, had I done that bet like 2 months earlier when I had first mentioned it, because the payout would have been thousands more. But I think I won like a couple of thousand, got my whole gym.
Yeah, and there's like there's a whole science to futures bets and then hedging it as the season goes along. But, you know, Tom is a great guy. I already texted him after he won, congratulated him, and told him, like, you got to come on the show and talk. And he promised me he would. We just got to work out the schedules. But if you do follow Thomas Casale, he's one of the great talents. Started out here at Sports Grumblings. He's an OG Sports Grumblings. One of the funniest, most insightful people on all sports. I'd love to have him on soon, and I'm sure we will. All right. Let's move on to the next topic.
All right. So, Big John.
Yes.
There was a big trade in the NFL.
Yep.
Boy, that term big is being thrown around for a lot of trades and things, but it's true. You know? So, the Eagles and the Saints made a trade. Big John, why don't you break down the trade? Because, ironically, there were were no players involved. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say this was strange in the way it was constructed. So the Saints acquired Philadelphia's 16th overall pick in the first round, 19th overall pick in the first round, and the Eagles' sixth-round pick, which worked out to number 194, in exchange for the 18th overall pick this year.
This is what the Eagles get.
This is what the Eagles get back. They get back a third-rounder this year, which works out to number 101. They get back a seventh-rounder, which works out to 237. They get a first-rounder next year and a second-rounder in 2024. So what is this? And it sounds strange. There's a lot of picks being thrown around.
Right now, there's a lot of theories. There's a lot of from quarterback to waiting. So there is no right or wrong answer, Big John.
Yeah.
What's your take?
Here's my take. I love this trade. I love this trade because it shows you what both teams are thinking. It kind of reveals the position they're in. So first of all, Philadelphia had three first-round picks this year.
That's a massive salary cap.
Right, but exactly. No matter who they took, they're locked into a certain salary cap commitment.
Exactly.
Right? So Philadelphia says to itself, they probably looked at the board and said, look, it's not a good draft for quarterbacks.
So, Big John, for the audience, what John is saying about slotted, meaning where you fall, pick 1, 2, 3, 4, there's an X amount of dollars in that contract. There is no more of this Sam Bradford into the good roles.
Right.
Now he's slotted. So the Eagles know, based off those picks, what it's going to cost him in salary cap.
Give or take a few percentage points, it's always within a very narrow band, and that's according to the collective bargaining agreement. So they all live by it.
Which John hates.
Whatever. But my point is now, what happened is Philly – is rolling with Jalen Hurts, right?
Right. That's all you hear.
Yeah. So they're rolling with him, at least for one more year. They have him on a cheap contract because he was a second-round pick, so he didn't cost them first-round money. If he does well this year, right, they take those picks that they delayed, and guess what? They're now being able to draft best talent available, and they'll have the ammunition to do it.
Well, Hurts is young, isn't he?
Huh?
Hurts is young, still on that first contract, right?
Sure, yeah. I believe in Hurts, actually. I think he needs to get coached up. He needs some experience. But physically, I think he's got all the tools. And they save money. They save cap space. That's the important thing. Now, why did New Orleans take this on when they're in cap hell?
Well, actually, they kind of got it a little bit out of cap.
Yes, they got out of it, but there's
– put it.
Yeah, but they're not necessarily in great shape.
They're still
tight. Yeah.
And now, do they have a strong free agency because of that?
No, they lost a lot of good players. They lost Terron Armstrong, their left tackle. He went to Miami as part of that Miami spending spree. They had to bring back Jameis Winston. They probably couldn't commit to Deshaun Watson when they were trying to get trade for him.
Well, they tried for him.
But I'm sure they couldn't match what other people did, financially. So, how do you rebuild? By getting two first-round picks in that middle of the first round, if they could get two good players, and that's always a chance with the draft, right? But assuming you're confident in your front office.
But, John, you need to rebuild. Are they planning to rebuild, or are they thinking they can make a run now?
I think they're planning to rebuild while remaining competitive. So I don't think they got two picks so they can go get a quarterback. I mean, it's a possibility, but I doubt it. I think they're going to wait till next year.
And that's what you're saying about the Eagles, too, because you like Hurts.
I like Hurts. Now, I think Jameis Winston is a serviceable quarterback. I don't know that he's a franchise quarterback anymore, but he's a serviceable quarterback. I'm not as down on him as a lot of other people are. I think he's maturing. And I think if they have – now –
do you think they're going to use – before – I don't want to digress too much, but do you think they're going to – they were strong defense – statistically, at least if I remember correctly, and they had a strong rushing attack. So my thought process, and I don't know what yours is, but I kind of just assume it's a complementary offense. In a sense, the quarterback's not going to drive this machine.
No, it's not.
Based on the game plan.
So if you think, what do the Saints need where they can get a big impact? Well, they lost Jenkins to retirement. They lost one of the Williams brothers, out of the second. The secondary has taken a lot of hits this offseason.
They got to rebuild their defense.
They need to rebuild their defense. They need to add offensive line. I mean, they could probably get by with what they got, even with the loss of Armstrong, but they could pick him up. But they could use a second, you know, one of the later picks.
So, John, you're saying you think they're going to be drafting to have an impact this year, and because of that, these are slotted contracts, so they don't have
they're
to
locked
go
in
out
for
of
5 years. They're locked in for 5 years. So what I'm saying is, it's not a quarterback. I would be shocked if they packaged those two picks to move up to get one of the quarterbacks. I would be shocked. What I'm likely thinking is they're trying to get two impact trench players, the kind of guys who have 10, 12-year careers. Like, if you think about it, you get yourself another Cam Jordan if you can, and God knows it's easier said than done. Cam Jordan's been a terrific defensive lineman for many years, right? But you get someone like a Cam Jordan in the middle of the first round, which is possible. There's a lot of depth at the D-line position. You might be able to get yourself a nice corner or a good safety. Those guys can play 10 years if they're good for you. And
right,
at reasonable
but it's
prices.
Still a hit or miss. It's still a hit or miss.
No, all drafting is a hit or miss, let's be honest. But like, you increase your chances by being in the middle. And then, you know, now being in the middle potentially also allows them to deal up and down the board more. Like, they could pick more draft capital by moving down in the first round.
That's right. And let's be honest. Let's say they don't see their player. What if they keep moving down, and they say something like Pickett slides? Because I think if any of the two QBs are going to slide, it's going to be Pickett. But never say never. So yeah. It sounds to me, John, there wasn't a winner in this as much as there were two winners.
Yeah, there were
two. Final comments on it?
There were two winners to this. And one of the more out there theories that I've heard is that they were willing to deal next year's first because there's a feeling that Sean Payton's going to want to come back to coaching.
Oh, yeah, that's what I think. Yeah.
But the Saints own his rights.
Oh, they'll trade him.
A la Gruden. You're right. So there's a possibility that they're thinking like, and look, not to allege any conspiracies, but maybe Sean Payton said, I'm coming back in a year, but I'm not coming back to you. So why don't you...
Well, they have his rights. I mean, you said they have his rights.
They have his rights. And look, are you trying to tell me Jimmy Johnson wouldn't pay to have Sean Payton go coach the Cowboys after this disaster with McCarthy?
No. Jimmy Johnson would not pay him. Jerry Jones would.
That's right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misspoke. Jerry Jones. Are you trying to tell me Jerry Jones?
You rarely make him. I love it. I got to jump on it.
Are you trying to tell me Jerry wouldn't jump?
Jerry would, not Jimmy.
For a second? Of course he would. So anyway, my point. So I think there's a lot. But like I said, I love this trade because it's more strategic in nature. It's kind of showing you where both teams are at. Like the Eagles, think about how confident they are that they're saying, we're good. We're good. We don't need all three first-round picks, right? We're good. And the odds are they're not going to hit on all three.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I buy that. I think it's, as you said, this is the business. And at the end of the day, they looked at those numbers. They look at where they're at in the rebuild. And it was a strategic decision. But that said, you could be absolutely right. I just think that fans, and sometimes we as analysts, you know, we love the game so much that – you kind of forget it's business. It's a business first. People don't realize that.
Yes. It's
all right, Big John.
Yes.
Let's talk about one of my favorite players of all time. People may not understand it, but I have mentioned this before. I love rooting for the underdog.
Yep.
I do. You know, coming from third world country, seeing my parents overcome the odds. So I don't know why. It's a quirk in me. Frank Gore. I'm going to talk about him up until his collegiate career. Then I want to hear everything about his NFL career. But real quick to the audience here, Frank Gore overcame two ACL tears. His second one, he had beaten out Willis McGahee, who went on to have a pretty solid NFL, actually an elite career for a couple of seasons with TD, if I remember. But he was a better than average player.
Oh, yeah.
As a freshman, he was behind Kenton Portis. Not one, but two ACL tears. And then he came out with that stigma. You can't fault anybody for having that stigma. His career's done. He had two ACL tears. Well, not that it was done. It was to be very short, and you can't predict the needs.
Right.
And not only did he overcome, he was one of these quiet players So many may not know this, but he thrived with the elite backs in too many ways that I want to list right now. But as a pro, this is the man with the analytical plan, Big John. Tell me a little bit about him. Do his numbers warrant, I guess I'm asking, does his number warrant him as a Hall of Fame player?
That's a great question. When you consider people for the Hall of Fame, there's two schools of thought, right? One school of thought is, look at the numbers. If the numbers are there, they deserve to get in. There's another school of thought that says, however, you have to take their careers in context. Were they impact players? Were they the best or most influential players during their time in their sport, right? So, for example, when you look at Gore, let me read off some of these numbers. Played until age 37, 38. Played for five teams, the 49ers, the Colts, the Dolphins, the Bills, and the Jets. Career rushing yards, 16,000. Yards per carry, 4.3. 81 rushing touchdowns. Almost 500 receptions, 484. Almost 4,000 receiving yards, 3,985.
What about his unique records? Did he have any unique records or any records where it's him and the elites, or are there any records with him and Hall of Fame peers? The reason I ask is that's who you're judged against to get in. Am I correct?
So he's one of, what, 31 running backs who got 10,000 yards rushing?
Right. Yeah, so
it's very exclusive.
I'm sure there's been thousands of running backs since NFL started. So.
And only one of four who ran for over 15,000. So when you look at the other three that went in.
That's the elite.
Emmitt Smith, Walter Payton. Barry Sanders, and I'm trying to think. No, that was it. That was the three. Barry Sanders, Walter Payton, and Emmitt Smith, right?
15,000, right?
Yeah, the 15,000 plus. So, listen, when you look at just the numbers, you're like, wow, why even ask? Like, the TDs aren't there as much as Emmitt, and, you know, but.
But didn't he have from linemen, see, as fantasy players,
yes,
the yards from scrimmage, because now, before, early on, fantasy used to separate them, but now they just kind of, it's two scoring points, but they just combined it into one. So you're talking from scrimmage, you're looking at what, 12 seasons?
Close to 20,000 yards in his career from scrimmage. Like,
yeah, and that's unique.
Yeah,
that's the team concept of football.
Yeah, and ironically, 99 total TDs from scrimmage, one short of 100. Like, he had 81 rushing and 18 receiving. So, but listen, those numbers themselves are not in question. I don't think anyone would ever say, look, the numbers aren't good enough. They're good enough. Here's the problem. He played for 16 years. He entered the league in 2005. He retired, functionally retired in 2020.
Technically, he hasn't retired.
Well, I was going to say functionally he retired in 2020.
Right.
So that's 16 seasons. Now, there's always been a bias, perhaps unjustly, in the minds of a lot of Hall of Fame voters for what I call endurance numbers, meaning – that a lot of the numbers were accumulated because they just played forever.
You know, you are absolutely correct, John, but let me ask you this.
Yeah, I was going to say, before you ask your question, a good example, say, for baseball Hall of Fame is Jack Morris. Or the pitcher for the Dodgers, Sutton. Like, Sutton got 300 wins without ever winning 20 in a year. In one season.
That's even more impressive. You know, right? each rule is there for a reason, and it's unique. And I'm aware of that, but this is where I don't know if you considered it, and if you have, I guess I disagree, but that's because it's usually the quarterback who has lasted that long. Dave Craig comes to mind. Great quarterback for the Seahawks, but nobody in their right mind would sit there and say he was Hall of Fame.
Well, no, not at all. No.
I wouldn't say he was Hall of Fame, you know. However, the running back position is the exact opposite.
Well, there's a lot of wear and tear. Yeah.
It's not a wear and tear. It's a brutal beating because they want to tackle you and hurt you. And it's not like a receiver. You're out in the open or you can see the hit coming. It's bam, bam, bam.
Oh, and it's at the line of scrimmage. And I've done plenty of articles analyzing.
What's your take on the longevity then? Don't you think with a knee rebuilt twice.
Yes. Listen, I didn't say that I discount endurance and longevity. I'm saying that there's only a small number of people who vote on these things. And in
you
some,
think they'll be swayed.
Right. I think some of them may look at it and say, it did take them. Look, what about Terrell Davis? It's the opposite, right? They say good numbers, but didn't play long enough. Same thing with Dale Sayers. Right?
Yeah. But that's why it has to be a combination.
Right.
Everybody saw Gale's greatness.
Yeah.
But he had no time to.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. You have to take it in context. Yeah. So if I had a bet, I think Frank Gore gets in. I don't know if he's a first or second or third ballot Hall of Famer.
Oh, it's a stacked year, so I don't think he'll get in this coming year.
But I think he'll get in, and he won't have to wait 15 years like Harry Carson or something. He'll get in. And I think justifiably so. And I think the part that you mentioned repeatedly, which I think is so important, he did it after coming off two ACL injuries, which is amazing. I can't even begin. Look at Saquon Barkley. At his age, roughly the same age as when Frank Gore may have had his first or second ACL, Barkley's still trying to come back after two seasons.
Exactly. And, the running back for the Minnesota, Terry something.
You're thinking of Smith.
Terry Smith.
I don't remember if his first name was Terry. Smith, number 26. I could see the name. I could see it in my head.
He came up at the same time as Mitchell for the Redskins. They're both running backs. And I had to choose between Terry Allen. That's it. I had to choose him and Terry Allen. And I drafted him, and he just exploded. Then the next year, I had the ACL tear.
But he had those little chicken legs, though.
He kind of like every other year had an ACL tear, and then came back strong. Yeah. So I think he belongs. I think you got to put things in context.
I agree.
You know, Terrell Davis was the reason they have a Super Bowl. Gale Sayers and the relationship of bonding in an era of racial division. To see that story, the impression. I don't believe in fate per se, but they transcended. Gale Sayers transcended. He got in because of football, but to me, he was more of an icon. He transcended and rose above it, and he was a special player. And that's how I view. That's how I view him here.
Yeah,
Frank Gore. But I guess my final take on it is, on the political side, this is why I love Frank Gore. He took advantage of the opportunity few men with God-given talent like him have and achieved greatness that I talk about. And to me, that's the American story. Yeah. And in identity politics, they'd rather have Frank Gore talk about how he was mistreated in the ghetto versus overcoming everything.
And I can't emphasize enough, Frank Gore, when you follow his career, ultimate professional. Professional. Like, you never heard a bad word about him. I think, William, and obviously you were a lot closer to a lot of the beat writers back in his day. I never heard one guy saying, there's scuttlebutt that Frank Gore is a cancer, or that Frank Gore is bitching about not getting enough carries, or that he's complaining about it. Like, you never heard any of that about Frank Gore.
Right.
I don't recall him holding out. He may have. I don't ever recall him. And by the way, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I'm saying, like, he would probably be a coach's and an owner's dream. Just a professional guy, always bringing the younger players, training them up, coaching them on the field. Like, I think everyone always said, like, when you brought Frank Gore into your locker room, you were bringing in the leader. You were bringing in a professional and someone who, even though his skills were diminishing, showed others how to be professionals. And I think that's also a value add. Maybe not Hall of Fame worthy, but definitely a value add.
I agree. I disagree in the sense that he is Hall of Fame.
I agree. And, yeah, I'm saying just being a pro isn't necessarily something that a Hall of Fame voter goes, oh, he's a pro, check.
I do worry about CTE issues with somebody who's played that long with him. Yeah.
I mean, look, nobody knows what's going to happen, but knock on wood, so far he seems fine. And I heard he's going into boxing.
Well, I think he wants to work with the 49ers is what I will.
He wants to retire as a 49er. I know that.
Right, but no, he does want to go work with them.
Oh, in the front office?
When, if this is all just him saying this because he's still got to actually get it done, but, well, power to him. And regardless, great story. Great story. We got I think that's about it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've done ourselves a good show today. It seemed to be a little bit chippier than usual. But, so let's just say this. Let's thank everyone who bothered to tune into this mess. Thank you for joining us once again on Points on the Board. For William Del Pilar and myself, Big John, please join us again next week where we'll have more hot topics to talk about. I shouldn't say next week, William. Next episode.
Exactly.
Join us because we do more than one a week, obviously. But join us next time. We'll have other great topics, some pop culture, some sports, some politics. So join us. And one thing you're going to know for sure, William is going to bring the sassiness associated with Puerto Ricans. No doubt about that, William.
There you go. Don't forget, give us the plug. Where should they visit to find any previous podcasts?
Yes, please go to sportsgrumblings.com. All the podcasts are up on that. And pretty soon, very soon, as a matter of fact, coming to your favorite podcast platform, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, wherever. We're going to be everywhere, folks, nationwide, worldwide, everywhere in the universe. Points on the Board for your entertainment pleasure.